4022 Radio Great Southern. Well, our next guest is no stranger. In fact, we have been talking to this lady for the past 4 years. In that time, Fiona McCallum from Adelaide has produced 5 books, would you believe? And they are doing exceptionally well. Now, number 6. And this is, in fact, the 3rd in a series that she called the Button Jar series. So we've had 3 books, and the last one is called Meant to Be. And it's just been published. It's available around the shops, and you should buy it because it's a fascinating third part of this trilogy. And the lovely Fiona McCallum's joined us on the line from Adelaide. Hello, how are you?
Hi, Pat. Wonderful to be chatting with you again.
Oh, dear. This is number 6. You realise that?
Yes.
Yes.
And my head, sometimes it makes my head spin. Been a bit busy.
Well, I must be the only person who's talked to you 6 times, I suspect.
I think so.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
And, of course, all our interviews are, in fact, on your website, aren't they?
They are, and people have been enjoying them because I get the odd note.
Yeah, well, that's good. Well, that's what it's all about. Yeah. Now, this has been, here we are, almost at the end of 2014. I suppose it's fair to say for you, this has been a frenetic year. I mean, you did tell me once, some time ago, you wanted to write a book a year. You wanted to be like Agatha Christie. Blimey, Charlie, you've written 6 in 5 years, even though you had a bit of a head start because you already had a manuscript before it was first published.
Yeah, I did have a head start, and I'm a wee bit tired in December. Now December's come around. Yeah, I'm not getting as much writing done as I want to. I'd love to be able to write 2 a year and put out 2 a year, but I think I've said before, it takes 2 months around about to edit them. So you lose 2 months there, and then 4 months with putting 2 out, and then all the other things that go on. So it's finding the actual time to write. And then sometimes when you actually have the time to write, the book doesn't want to be written. The ideas have to be there. You can't force creativity.
Absolutely. Now, the fascinating statistics that I notice, that in fact in 3 years you sold over 150,000. Nowhere Else in Wattle Creek, and you became Australia's top-selling rural fiction author in 2012. And, of course, last year you were featured in the top 10 Australian best-selling authors. That is quite an achievement.
It's been incredible. And, you know, especially when you know and think that it took me 9 years to get published, and I've got countless rejections from agents and publishers, and it just goes to show that dreams can come true. And that, you know, when your planets align, because I didn't do anything different. It just kind of happened.
It just clicked.
Yeah, it's just amazing, and it's incredible that so many people are enjoying the books and connecting with them, because I write stories very much from my heart and the sort of books that I like to read myself. And I know it sounds a bit selfish, but when I write, I don't tend to give too much thought about who's going to be reading them at the end. I just tell a story that's really passionate to me that I feel I have to tell.
Yeah, and of course it's very much in the rural genre because that's where you grew up. Now, I did see some silly comment that said, oh, rural romance, absolute codswallop. Where do they get that from?
Oh, this is a bit of a bugbear of mine.
Well, I'm not surprised.
Oh, you'll get me on my high horse.
That's all right. You can wax lyrical about that, because, I mean, it's objectionable because they're not rural romance novels.
No, they're not, because and there's nothing wrong with romance, and there's nothing wrong with rural romance. It has its place and it's very, very popular. It's just my objection lies in the fact that my stories are heartwarming journey of self-discovery stories, which may or may not have romantic elements. And for me, a romance, true romance, has to be a story that focuses mainly on a romance. You know, boy meets girl, lives happily ever after, whatever. But the search for love, specifically. And my books, that's not what I write.
Definitely not.
So it bothers me a bit. I get a bit narky about it. But, you know, labels. People like to put labels, and people get them wrong sometimes, or they make assumptions if they haven't read it, or, you know, it's just tricky.
It's funny, though, when I read your books, and I do love reading them, and I occasionally go back and read them again for about the third or fourth time or whatever, and it's very much as you would be, you read it and you can hear the voices in your mind, and it's very much natural conversation. There's nothing forced there. There's nothing false about it, if you like.
That's me. I'm chatty.
Exactly.
And everything's a long rambling story with me. It's just, I don't know, they just come out the way they want to come out, Pat. It's just, I guess it's just my writing voice is a bit similar to my speaking voice.
Yes, so when you're writing, do the words, do you hear them in your ears?
Yeah, and it's a complicated thing, and I've tried to stop questioning it, but when I sit down to write, I'll have the next sentence written down of what the next bit is to write from the day before, and then I will focus on that sentence and I'll read it over and over in my head, and somehow, if it's a writing day, and it's not always a writing day, the picture will form in my mind of actually seeing the scene happen like a movie, and then I just pick up my pencil and it just flows, and sometimes, and it's like I'm in a trance or something.
Yeah.
And then it just flows, and it could be a scene of, you know, several hundred words, or it could be several thousand. And if it's a long scene, I'll look up hours later and kind of not realise where the time's gone. And I handwrite.
So yes.
Then I type it up, and it's almost like, I think, oh, that's well written. Did you write that? Oh, it's an odd thing. And I just, as arrogant as it might sound, I think it's a gift. And I just kind of, I don't know, I stopped trying to question it, I guess. It just happens.
Now, of course, you also, as a writer, have to be pretty disciplined about when you're going to write and what you're going to do.
Yes, I'm beyond disciplined, I think. I'm a bit obsessive. So I start at 8 in the morning. I write in the mornings, and I have a very strict routine where I actually go back to bed fully dressed to write, propped up with a heap of pillows, and as I said, I handwrite. And it's always after my second cup of coffee that I start writing, and I will also start the morning with reading whatever current book I'm reading, and that tends to spark the creativity somehow, because I think when I'm reading, it gives the brain the opportunity to percolate and work out what it's, you know, going to say. It's, as I said, Pat, it's all very odd. And then, and I sound like a nutcase.
No, you don't. No, you don't.
And then I tend to finish at 11, 11:30, sometimes 12, and sometimes if it's not the if the words don't come, then it will be a reading day, which is fine, because as much as I'm a bit of a control freak and I'm really hard on myself, I've accepted that you just can't force the words. If they're not there, they're just not there, and no amount of angst or tearing your hair out is actually going to help. So you just accept that, you know, whatever bit needs to be written next needs more time.
All right, here's a question. What do you like to read?
Anything. I read a lot of commercial women's fiction.
Yeah.
I also really enjoy the odd crime fiction. Maeve Binchy's one of my ultimate favourite authors, and she passed on now, which is terribly sad. And also Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who wrote the Sherlock Holmes, was also a favourite, but I haven't reread him for many years. Mainly women's fiction, because that's what I'm writing myself.
So what about your competitors in the markets? Do you read any of theirs?
Well, I don't tend to read rural fiction, because most of them are rural romance, and romance is
right.
What I like to read.
Exactly, yeah.
So, I just don't. I've read a couple that have looked, you know, the blurbs have looked like they're not so romance-based. But, you know, I tend to read about a book a week, and so it's hard for me to remember what I've read and enjoyed and you know, keep all the separate stories straight in the titles and the authors. And I've currently got a to-be-read pile of, I think it's 43 at the moment.
Oh, wow.
So I'm a bit behind.
Oh, well, you've got Christmas.
I'm behind in my writing too, though, sadly, Pat.
Ah, yes. Now, of course, as I said, this has been a busy year. You've got two novels have come out this year, and you're also writing another one, which is coming out in April. We'll talk about that later. But, of course, in between time, you've had to go and do all sorts of things like in-store appearances and all that sort of rubbish.
Yeah, there's a lot to this business. You know, as you know from previous chats, I ran a small business as a writing and editing consultant while I funded my dream of being a novelist. And, you know, I thought all the networking and so forth was hard work, but that was nothing compared to this, because there's things like, because I don't have an agent, and so I run everything myself, and as I've said, admitted to, put my hand up to, I'm a control freak, so I don't, you know, I rely on myself to do everything, including website and social media. It all takes a lot of time, Pat.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
you don't spend too much time on Facebook, I take it.
As much as I need to, because it's really important to have a social media presence in this day and age, and it's a really important marketing tool, I've decided that I will only be on Facebook. I'm not doing Twitter, and I'm not blogging, and I'm not doing whatever else there is out there. I just decided that one was enough, because it can completely suck your time if you let it. But the frustrating thing is that there's so much to do, but the one thing as a writer that you really desperately just want to do is write.
Yes.
And it's hard to find that time, and also then it's hard to find that time with the headspace without all the other stuff that you've got on your to-do list, you know, crowding in. And then it's also hard to have all those things in line and also the story ready to be written.
Yeah, there are so many outside distractions, aren't there?
Oh, yes, yes.
Very tough.
You have to be really disciplined, I think.
Yeah.
Which, luckily for me, I've been self-employed now for over 14 years.
Yeah.
So, for me, discipline isn't a problem.
No.
And I don't have kids and, you know, that side of distraction. I'm here on my own. I've just got a cat that yells at me quite a lot.
Particularly when it's hungry, I suspect.
Oh, no, he's always hungry.
Oh, yeah, aren't they? Always. Yeah, I got two like that too, I tell you.
Yeah.
Meow, meow, feed me, feed me.
Oh.
Yeah, you know all about that. Now, what about a social life? Is there a life outside of all of this?
There is. I'm a bit of a hermit, though, by choice. I'm quite happy with my characters as friends. That sounds sad, doesn't it? But, yeah, I don't know. They say the business of writing is lonely, but I don't find it lonely at all. It's solitary, but certainly not lonely. I've got friends I catch up with, but my best friends don't live in vicinity, so
right.
I spend a lot of time on the phone with them. Yeah, I tend to be, and I'm getting worse, I think, in terms of just not wanting to leave the house, because I'm just quite happy doing my own thing.
Mm. But there is a possibility, of course, that we might do some travel next year, because looks like the Brits and the Yanks want to actually publish some of your books.
That is true.
Isn't that exciting? Well, sort of exciting.
Yeah, it is. And apparently it's really hard for Aussie authors to break in to the US and the UK markets, and especially those who write rural, or so I've been told. And yes, my first two books are coming out in the US and the UK. One in the US, Paycheck, and Paycheck and Nowhere Else in the UK. But they've been given different names, different covers that I'm
not overly impressed by the sound of it.
Sorry?
Not overly impressed by the sound of it.
They have apparently have very different markets, and so when we look at covers that come from those markets, often it's not to our liking because it works there and may not necessarily work here.
Right.
But I've got to keep an open mind and trust that they know their market and hope, cross my fingers, that it works. But I am planning on doing a trip over to have a look at the market when they're on the shelves and just see what I can learn about it.
Yeah. So how important is it if you're actually publishing overseas to actually have an agent in those countries?
Well, at the moment, I'm being published by Harlequin's other territories.
Yeah.
So that's how that's come about, and I haven't needed an agent for that. But as you know, I've got the other books that they haven't shown an interest yet in publishing in the other territories. I guess they are waiting to see, you know, do the first one or two with a test as a test case.
Yeah.
And so I'm actually starting to look for an agent in the UK and or the US. Some will service both territories, but a lot of them, you know, you'll need one in each area. But because I'm really keen to forge a serious, successful career over there. So that's, and also I just don't know the market well enough.
No.
So that's why I'm looking to get an agent over there. Here it's not so bad because I can just pop over to Sydney and visit my publishers and,
yes,
you know, talk to them and have a great relationship with them. But it's all just so unknown for me, and really it's getting so busy with what I've got going on here that I really do need a bit of help.
Well, that'll be a bit of a challenge because you don't like going anywhere.
No, every time I think about booking tickets and things, I think, oh, then I've got to organise the cat for boarding and then I've got to leave the house and, oh, no, it's all too hard. But I will. I'm determined I'm going to.
It's a
I'm such a homebody and,
yeah,
you know, it's... Yeah.
It's a necessary evil, though, isn't it, really? If you want to succeed in that market, you've got to go and look for yourself and see what the hell's going on.
Well, I think if you want to be informed, like I do, then yes. I think plenty of Australian authors get their agent and deal with their agent and possibly not, you know, go over there. But I just want to see books on shelves and see what sort of formats they have and have a good look at their covers, because we don't really know. When you look online here, you don't know exactly what cover you're seeing.
No. Now, what about e-books? Are you doing any of that?
Yes, my books come out in print and e-book at the same time.
Right.
So when you say I've sold 150,000 copies, that's print books, and I think I've sold over 40,000 e-books.
Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
They're proving quite popular.
Yeah.
And my last two books actually debuted on the iTunes iBooks chart.
Right.
Which is a bit exciting.
Indeed.
I make myself get excited about e-books, Pat, because
yeah,
they don't really float my boat. I like the feel of and smell of real books.
Yes, and one would hope that the future is going to be in real books. I mean, you hear all these things from time to time saying, oh, well, you can get everything online, therefore we're not going to print. I mean, some newspapers are going down that track.
Yeah.
I would hate to see books go down that track.
I don't think it will, Pat. I think there's going to be enough people that are old-fashioned and romantic at heart like I am,
yeah,
that will keep the demand there for a good quality book. And actually, this is interesting because I have had a couple of messages on Facebook and via email of readers telling me that they've read my books on ebook but then gone on to buy the paper copy as well because they enjoyed it so much and want it in their collection.
Ah, how interesting.
Interesting.
How interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fascinating, isn't it?
Because I don't read a book twice.
Yeah. Is that so?
Other than my own, which I have to read a million times.
Of course.
Writing, editing and proofreading.
Right. So you've got a collection and a half of books.
Sorry?
You've got a collection and a half of books, have you?
I've got hundreds, yes.
Yeah.
I love books and I keep fitting in bookshelves wherever I can fit them in my little cottage. Bookshelves everywhere.
Yeah, it's interesting though, you see, because I like to read a book several times and I will go back to a book, you know, maybe a couple of years down the track and go back to something that I like because I do like reading a lot.
Yeah.
You know.
I can't think of a book that I've read more than once.
Is that so?
Other than, this is a bit funny, I'm currently writing a sequel to Wattle Creek.
Ah.
And because that was published, well, I wrote it ages ago and it was published a few years ago, I had to reread the book.
Yeah.
And I sat and read it for the first time as a real book in the way that I normally sit in bed, read a book. And the whole way through it, I kept saying, oh, this is a good book. This is good. This is actually quite good. It was the weirdest thing, Pat, I tell you. So, yes, that's really the only book I've read.
Right, all right, fair enough. Well, yeah. The current one, which is on sale now, is called Meant to Be. It is the third in what you call the Button Jar series, in which Emily Oliphant was given a button jar by her, or left by her late grandmother, and discovered some nice diamonds in there, and she had a disastrous marriage and all that sort of garbage. Anyway, now this is the sort of the trilogy, if you like. I don't want to give away the whole story because obviously I want people to read the book. But
no.
The one thing that we will talk about is that when she was married to her husband John, who was a right pain in the whatever,
yeah.
He did bulldoze a brick cottage that was on the property that they owned, which she had high hopes of turning into a guest house or something or other.
Mm-hmm.
Then, of course, in the last book, he died, and she, because he hadn't changed his will, actually inherited the property. And so the dream of rebuilding this cottage actually comes true in this sequel.
It does, and the beautiful thing for Emily is that the idea to rebuild it comes from her new man.
Yeah, an architect.
Yeah, he's an architect slash builder from Melbourne. And I just think that's beautiful, and I love a bit of irony that, you know, her husband, who diddled her out of the settlement and lied about things, ended up giving her everything because he didn't change his will. I that tickles me.
It's a lovely. That really is a highlight for me. You know, that was a highlight of the last book when she inherited the property,
yeah.
And now here she is, really, I suppose, set up for life, basically.
She is. She'll always be a little bit of a worrier about money because she's always, you know, not had much, and her husband was quite controlling. But she's learning to trust that things will be okay. And she's got the lovely Jake, who I've got a big crush on.
Yeah.
he's just beautiful. And also the big thing with Meant to Be for me was I wanted it to round off her story,
yeah.
So to show readers that, yep, things are good for Emily now after all that she's been through. But the big thing for me was that I wanted her to have the opportunity to give back to her dear friends, Barbara and David, for all the help and support that they gave her when she desperately needed it, and also to Jake's sister, Simone, who really got them back together after a bit of a hiccup.
Yeah, it's very much, you know, a period of discovery, and particularly in the last, this one, Meant to Be, where the discovery comes to fruition, doesn't it?
It does.
Mm.
I'm just wondering which bit.
Well, if you start at the first book and you read the trilogy, and, you know, it is a voyage of discovery, if you like, for Emily, to find out who she is and what she is and, you know, where she belongs and what have you. And this is the culmination of that.
Yeah, and it's unusual, I think, for a trilogy to stay on the one character and their journey. And, you know, that's hard at times because for a book to work, it has to have enough ups and downs.
Mm.
And so that's why she's been put through the ringer a bit. But, yeah, she's accepted that her evil mother is the way she is, and they've had a bit of a showdown. And, you know, honestly, I'm not sure that Enid has really changed as much as we'd like to think she has by the end of the book, but there's a truce there, and won't give it away, but Emily's probably going to need her a little more.
Yes, an uneasy truce between mother and daughter, shall we say.
Yes.
One of the distractions in this book, this whole series that I discovered, of course, was the fact that diamonds in the button jar. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that they were a distraction because you didn't focus on them. Emily probably has no intention of selling them because they were her grandmother's anyway. And it was really just a sideline, if you like, to the books.
Yeah, it's just, to me, it's a metaphor for her connection to her grandmother and her wisdom that's got her through all these ups and downs. And there's no way she could part with something. She's horribly sentimental, just like I am. And, yeah, to me, the diamonds were never going to be the main story.
No.
It's always going to be her journey. And it's the diamonds that set her off for giving her the courage to stand up to herself, to her husband, and, you know, get herself a better life.
Indeed.
And draw on the memories of her grandmother and her wisdom.
Yeah. Now, of course, this was a trilogy, but you have left the door open, haven't you?
Yeah. You know, it's I've never referred to it as a trilogy.
No.
There are three books currently, and I have said that it is the third and most and possibly final book in the series.
The Button Jar series. Yeah.
Yes. And to me, it's definitely Emily's journey's finished.
Yeah.
However, yes, you're right. There are a lot of threads that I've left that could be taken up. and to be honest, I don't know what I'm going to do.
No, I mean that's for the future, isn't it? Yeah.
Because these ideas come and they come and go, and they come and go in, you know, weak or strong measure.
Yeah.
And if it's an idea that stays around a long time and it slowly snowballs to become an idea that is big enough and workable enough for a whole book, and then starts to insist and drive me mad, then it will get written. But if it just stays as a pondering of, oh, well, I wonder if, then, you know, I have to wait until it's something I'm so passionate about I can't ignore
until
anymore.
It crystallises in your brain and you think, I've got to do it. Yeah.
And I've always had a particular idea with this one, but I haven't quite worked out what direction to take it.
So. Okay. Well, the next one's coming out in April. Is this the sequel to Wattle Creek?
No.
Oh, that's another one.
Yes. Yeah,
oh.
This is the tricky thing, is that the publishing world works about 6, 8, 12 months out.
Right.
So this year, so we're just doing the cover and everything for Leap of Faith, which comes out April 1.
Right.
And so the one I'm writing at the moment, so that's already written. And
right, that's
I'm
already done.
Proofreading it this week. So this is how busy my head is.
Gee, you are far in front, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm reading the proof for one book for April. I'm talking about the book that's just come out with you, and I'm trying to write another one.
Oh, Lord.
You see why I don't need to get out much?
Yeah, I can see that. You're a busy lady, busy lady.
Yeah. But it's all good fun, and I love it.
Yeah.
And I'm blessed with ideas, so that's all fantastic.
Yeah.
Leap of Faith is a horse story.
Ah.
Another one.
Very
close to my heart, as all my books are.
Indeed.
It's,
well.
Yeah, it's lovely.
One has to say, you have done tremendously well. When you think of all those years where you struggled and, you know, back in 2001 when you wrote your first manuscript, Lord, you know, 13 years down the track, and here we are with six books published. You're a best-selling artist.
That.
I mean, God, it's amazing, isn't it?
I stopped, I decided that it was just all too depressing because it really hurts. The rejections really hurt.
Of course.
And so I had actually decided that I would I need to write. Write is not a want. I need to, otherwise I go mad. It's something that only creative people can really understand.
Yeah.
But there's this need there that it's, I guess it's like drug takers.
Yeah.
You know, you just have to have your fix. And so you could ignore it and try to outrun it for weeks or maybe months and get away with it, but then it will creep back in and grab you. So I decided that, this rejection thing was just too hard, too depressing. I'll just write and not worry about getting published. And then quite by accident went and did a weekend, went to Sydney for a course. I don't know if I've told you this.
Yes, you did. Yes, we've heard the story, but it's an interesting story nevertheless.
In the end.
Yeah. You know? Isn't that fascinating? So you've produced these wonderful books, and look, people love them because they're buying them. We know that because the runs are on the board.
Well, it's just that's the amazing thing, Pat, is how many lovely emails I get from people who've been touched by my simple stories and my characters.
It's, and that's the, see, that's the key. Simplicity is the key.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know.
It is.
They just seem to love them, which...
Yeah. And these are, but you know, every time I read one of these, and they're real people, you know? You can imagine these people doing what they do and saying what they say.
Yeah, I think they are a realistic portrayal of life and the ups and downs that most of us go through.
Absolutely.
You know, they are simple stories, but, you know, I've had emails from readers saying, you know, I so identified with that, I'm going through it myself, you've given me hope. You know, it, and that's just, there's no greater compliment.
Absolutely.
Them. Amazing.
Indeed. Well, Meant to Be is on the shelves now, published by Harlequin. People are buying it, and we shall look forward to catching up with you for chat number 7 next April.
That would be lovely.
Not a problem, and we're delighted to have you on the program, and you are part of our programming, and we love having you, and thank you for your lovely books. I mean, they really are, I think they're very heartwarming in many respects, and,
hope
you know,
so.
And I enjoy them because having worked a lot in rural Australia, of course, I mean, I can relate to a lot of this stuff, you know, and the people that I've met over 50-odd years in broadcasting, you know.
So it's, I really appreciate your support.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you so much,
Pat.
Oh,
look, it's always pleasant to talk to you because you're like me. We chat a lot.
I'm hopeless.
Ah! No, you're not. You're delightful. Fiona, thank you so much indeed for your time. Really appreciate it. We'll catch up with you in a few months' time.
And you have a lovely Christmas.
And the same to you.
Best wishes to all your listeners for a safe and happy Christmas.
Thank you so much indeed for your time. Fiona McCallum joining us there on the line from Adelaide. Her latest novel is called Meant to Be, and you can buy it at all good bookstores.